Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is a special live podcast from this year's Golf Industry Show. Special thanks to Toro for putting it all together, but I am joined by Edric Funk and Matthew Wharton, superintendent at Carolina Golf Club, and we talk a lot about innovation in the space of turf. So this is obviously a hot topic with sustainability never more present in a lot of aspects of society and really in golf courses as we look to the future. So we talk a lot about the innovation coming from Toro with the autonomous mowers, as well as the, you know, different hacks and things that Matt has done over his career at Carolina Golf Club to innovate in his own way. Without further ado, here is the podcast with Matt and Edric.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Everybody for coming out to this, and special thanks to Toro for setting this up. It's really exciting to interview Matt and Edric here. So we got Matthew Wharton from Carolina Golf Club, master greenskeeper, former president of the Carolina's Golf Course Superintendents Association, and then we've got Edric Funk, who is the director of the Center for Technology Research and Innovation for Toro. So we're going to talk a little bit about turf, probably a little bit about life and innovation in life. So should be a fun conversation. So to kick things off, I think, Matt, you're in the Carolinas. You get a wide range of weather, and I'd love to hear a little bit about the unique challenges you face as a superintendent in the Carolinas.
Well, Andy, first and foremost, I want to say thank you for doing this, and thank you to Toro for having me. It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be here. I can't believe we've actually got folks out here watching us right now. But, you know, the Carolinas is in a what we call the transition zone portion of the United States. It's not really an ideal climate for growing grass 12 months out of the year. You can grow cool season grass, you can grow warm season grass, but it's hard to grow both. And that's what I do. I got cool season greens. We have bent grass greens at Carolina Golf Club. And then everything else is warm season grass, our tees, fairways, and rough. And we get a wide range of weather extremes, lots of rain, lots of drought. And we had both of that this past year. I mean, 2019 was our second wettest year in my 15 years at the club, with almost a foot and a half above average rainfall. But at the same time, we went 50 days without a drop at one point. We were 99 degrees on October the 2nd, so it's you get it all.
Yeah, definitely. It's just that transition zone in the country is so tough, as you alluded to, with the different grasses and the constraint. If there was one part of the country you're most envious of, you know, you look and say, I wish I was growing grass in that area. Say, not like you were looking to a job, but what zone of the country would you most ideally envious of?
Well, there's two answers to that. I'm always envious of the parts of the country that don't have humidity, because that is our biggest challenge by far in the Carolinas. But the nicest weather I've ever experienced is when the golf industry shows in San Diego. I went to San Diego for the first time in 2004, and I kind of jokingly said to my wife, I was like, well, you know, we could live out here on the streets if the rug ever got jerked out from under us.
Yeah. So, Edric, playing off that, you have a job, you know, you're creating innovation for different industries, but then specifically in the turf grass industry, you have superintendents that are applying the stuff that you're making for, you know, wide different problems that they face. How, when you're going about the innovation and product development process, are you considering how superintendents in different parts of the country and different parts of the world are using the product?
Yeah, no doubt about it. And in fact, it's one of the things that, as I started working for Toro now more than 23 years ago, One of the things I love most is how much our engineers, our product managers, everybody in the company really wants to understand the real challenges that our customers face. And our company certainly has a long history in turf grass management and with golf course management. And we truly, and I really mean this, truly view our superintendent customers as partners as we try to figure out how to bring those innovations and solutions out to the marketplace. And on one hand, you asked Matt about some of the unique challenges that he faces. As you go from property to property, region to region, there certainly are differences, but there are other people that share some of those same challenges, the transition zone challenges that Matt talked about, the humidity challenges. There are some of those common and unifying things that ultimately, if we can bring solutions to help one, there are probably more that benefit from that same technology.
For sure. It's as singular as a problem, you feel like, I run into this all the time. It's like, I feel like sometimes I'm the only person in the world with a problem. It's not true. Everybody's got probably, a lot of people have the same problem. Matt, you tweeted yesterday about robotics, and you said you scoffed 12 years ago at the idea of, robotics and turf. And I'm curious, over those 12 years, like, your perceptions obviously changed with it, but, what were your initial thoughts about robotics and how have they changed?
Yeah, that's a great question, Andy. And so I'll tell you the story. I was about a dozen years ago, I got invited to sit in on a little focus group panel to talk about a robotic fairway mower, and I just thought, well, that's the craziest thing in the world. How is a mower going to know if there's a stick in a fairway or a riser from a sprinkler head is, stuck in an elevated position from overnight? I just couldn't wrap my head around how something could be out there without an operator. And I just scoffed. I didn't even participate in the focus group. I just was like, I don't want any part of that. But, you look at the way technology and innovation has progressed over the last dozen years, societal changes. One of our biggest issues right now in the business is labor, and that's not just in the transition zone. It's not just in the United States of America. It's globally. It is very difficult to find young men and women that want to work outdoors, especially when they didn't really spend a lot of time playing outdoors. And that's just the generation we're kind of looking at. And so I think there's a lot of potential with these autonomous mowers. And I had a conversation with my Greens Committee chairman last year because labor was one of our biggest challenges last year. Despite the weather, the labor was the biggest headache. We had a lot of difficulty. I hired 10 new people on the staff last year, and I think only 3 remain. And I didn't terminate anybody. And some only lasted a month. But so he's asking me, he's like, well, what I hear about these robotic greens mowers, and I'm like, yeah, they're there. There's a few courses that have them, but I said, it's really going to take the major manufacturers putting these types of machines on the trade show floor in their booth before the market as a whole is going to start to buy in and you're going to start to see it. Now, are we going to see that mower on my golf course, next year? Probably not. 3 years from now? I don't know. 7 years from now? It's probably be a strong possibility. It's coming. And for me, it was just an exciting moment to think, okay, that's a major milestone,
Yeah, I think one of the things I've kind of heard from across the industry is the idea that these robotics are going to replace jobs, but to me, it seems like it would be more of a shift. Like, how would you envision your staff being, different roles and responsibilities if you had a machine that took care of the fairway and the rough?
Well, say? It's funny you should ask that because I actually had this conversation with my Greens chairman as well, and I haven't really shared this thought with any colleagues yet, but I think, you know how you always hear the term, what's old is new again? And you think back to how we used to maintain golf courses, say like back in the 70s and 80s, staffs were much smaller. Equipment was much larger. I mean, heck, I grew up mowing fairways with a tractor that had 7 cutting units. It was a wide swath. And we're starting here in the last year or two to see some of that come back, some bigger, wider units. And I think maybe, and I'm going to say within 7 to 10 years, the modern day golf course superintendent, it's going to be a little bit of a hybrid. I think the staffs are going to be smaller. It's going to be fewer people. There'll be some autonomous equipment, but there'll also be some equipment that's much larger. You know, maybe one guy to mow rough instead of two because he's got a water, you know, water machine to do the work. And I think you're just going to see a little bit of a contraction, but it's going to be highly efficient, technologically savvy. I think that's where we're headed. I think that's where we're going, Edric. How about you?
Yeah, Andy, as you were bringing up the question, as Matt talked about, I'd bring up one of the statements that our chief R&D engineer often makes as we're talking about innovation and what kinds of things we're pursuing. And he always says we need to look at where this technology can work, not get fixated on where it can't. And clearly there are plenty of completely valid reasons that people would have to say, I'm not going to use robotic technology or alternative energy products or whatever else. The question isn't can they do everything. The question is can they do anything? And as a supplement to Matt's team, to what his peers are trying to do, we certainly think that technology plays a role. I can tell you, certainly from the perspective of the Toro Company, our motivation isn't to eliminate jobs. It's to help people be more productive. I know one of the hot topics here at the show this year, there's been discussion about work-life balance and mental state of mind and stress and everything else. And I think if Matt had the ability to quickly and easily know where all of his equipment is, what jobs are done, is my irrigation system running, or has it turned off when it's supposed to, having to not wonder about that and worry about that or make a special trip to the golf course, I think has an opportunity. And with the autonomous mowing side of things, different people are going to have different opinions as to where that has a fit and when. We reference often the quote attributed to Bill Gates, where he said something to the effect of, we tend to overestimate how much things are going to change in 2 years and underestimate how much they're going to change in 10. And I think the comments Matt just made are right in alignment with that. It's not that the world's going to completely change over these next couple of years to where all of the products are going to be autonomous, but I can virtually guarantee you a decade from now, some of the things that people are scoffing at or concerned about will somehow find a way to be commonplace in operation.
Yeah, I was with a transition zone superintendent last night, and we were talking about autonomous mowers, and one thing he pointed out was that the ability to start mowing earlier in the dark is like a big advantage because of the sense of like it's really rough on the later holes because it can get so hot that you're mowing at a time that's not, you know, I'm mowing my lawn in the mornings or, you know, when I mow in the middle of the day in the summer in Chicago, people are like, that's really bad, you know?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, mowing is stressful on the turf, and if you're mowing at a time of day that's less than ideal, you know, typically with us, the only thing we're mowing after lunch is rough. You know, we get all, you know, obviously greens are done first thing in the morning. Fairways takes us about 4 to 4.5 hours. The goal or the objective is to get out ahead of play and stay ahead of play. And part of that is also, it's just, my team and I, we're preparing the course for you and your enjoyment. And so, you know, we want you to start your round on the first hole and play the golf course, you know, perfectly, you know, manicured for your enjoyment. And, you know, sometimes singles play fast and get in front of the mowers. And once they stop for one group, it seems like they're stopping for others. But you're exactly right. I think that was one of the comments somebody made last night when I was kind of scrolling through was, I wanted to just say, you folks are missing the point. But, you know, someone said, well, you know, how are they going to avoid golfers? And I'm thinking, they'll never see them. You know, you can start your mowers 3 a.m. and you could probably integrate it with your Toro irrigation, so it's not going to be on a hole where the sprinklers are running.
You know. Yeah, I think that's right on the money as well. I talked earlier about looking for where the technology can work, not getting fixated on where it can't. And we know there are things that are very repetitive for our golf course staffs, things that need to be repeated. The automating some of those processes has a chance to improve quality, to get the consistency that people are looking for. what the robots aren't good at is judgment and anticipation. And as much as we may often criticize some of the lack of common sense we see out of operators, they're making thousands of little judgments a day that are difficult, at least in the present day, for the robots to do. So we want to make sure that we can free up the good people, the intelligent people, the artists that are taking care of the golf course to use their judgment and use the robots for the jobs that people don't need to do.
So yesterday, Andy and I were having a little chat over here, and he was talking about how he thought putting a guy on a fairway unit, he thought, the poor guy, he's going to spend the next 4 to 5 hours just kind of, you know. And they're probably listening to the fried egg on their earbuds, Andy. But
I got to be careful. I might be cannibalizing my audience.
But I told him, I said, but the funny thing was that we were standing with two other superintendents, and I said, I guarantee you all three of us will tell you the same answer. When you start off in this business and you're the low guy on the pole and, you know, your job's to run the string trimmer, et cetera, you look at those guys that go out every morning on the fairway units and you're like, I want to be that guy. Nobody ever wanted to be the guy that mowed rough. Everybody wanted to be the guy that mowed fairways. So it was kind of instinctual as you progressed up the ladder in the business that you start to look for your better operate. Your better guys, your sharper guys, the cool guys got the fairway mowing job. If I could take two really sharp guys or three and have them do something else, that's going to be a tremendous improvement to what the team can accomplish.
Yeah, it reminds me of a conversation I had with Curtis James on the podcast. He was talking about how much he loves project work because one of the big reasons was from a management standpoint, he gets to break the monotony of his guys' days where it's not like every day we're just getting on the mower and mowing because, day in, day out, that can kind of become Groundhog Day, and he loves doing project work because it gives them an opportunity to really, do something new and find in new skills that they, didn't even know that they were really great at. So, in terms of managing a staff, obviously we've talked a little bit about the labor struggles that you have. In terms of breaking the monotony day in, day out, what type of tactics do you have?
Well, I mean, you're exactly right. And you use Groundhog Day as the analogy. I'll just show my age. I always refer to the old Dunkin' Donuts commercial. You remember that, Edric?
Yeah.
The guy coming in and out there,
time to make the donuts.
And I use that with my staff. And sometimes in our morning meetings, I'll be like, guys, I get it. What are you going to do tomorrow? The same thing I did yesterday. It does. It gets monotonous, very monotonous. But you just got to keep the mood light. If I was a football coach, I'd probably be referred to as a player's coach, mainly because I want to keep the mood light and keep it fresh. We're going to have fun. Yeah, we're going to go out here and do the same thing we did yesterday, but we're going to keep it. We're going to have fun. And you're exactly right. On a day when we get to do something out of the ordinary, oh, yeah, you can see it in, their faces light up, the energy level's up. Yeah, that's why I like tournament golf, too. Tournament golf can be a grind. But at the same time, it's a little different because you're taking what you do on a daily basis and you're just amplifying it. And so, yeah, that kind of gets your juices flowing.
And it's probably rewarding, you got to see, you see how good it looks and how it's playing and people, really enjoying it. So both of you guys are big problem solvers, obviously superintendents. You guys are solving new problems every day. I'm curious, in your managing team that's trying to solve really big problems, how do you guys go about when you have a problem, figuring out solutions, and is there a process that you guys have on the innovation side? And then is there a specific problem that you've faced that you've come up with a really unique solution that might not have, surfaced right away?
Well, yeah, I'll chime in on that first, Andy. The nature of your question, talking about problems, is exactly the focus that we try to keep in our R&D team. And we rally around the motto or the mantra of we work on problems, not on products. It's really easy when we work for a manufacturer that has all these products we see on display here in the trade show booth to get fixated on just making those products better. But that can be missing the point. And so, as I said real early in the discussion today, we try to make sure that all members of our team are plugged in with the customers, that we go out and spend time in the field, that we employ ethnographic type research where you're out there trying to develop that empathy with our customers. And it leads to better solutions. And it might not be making another version of the kind of products we make today. It might be looking at something completely different.
Yeah, it reminds me. A company I worked for a few years ago. We had Ben Horowitz, one of the great venture capital guys in the world, and he talked about how, you know, 95% of your time with problems should be identifying the actual problem, and only, you know, once you've actually identified the true problem, then 5% is focused on the solution. And when he said that, it was just something I thought about a lot. Is like, you know, actually finding the real problems oftentimes the toughest thing.
It's a great point, and I'll add to that. The other thing that's really key for us is to not too quickly get fixated on one solution. You know, we typically, when you're ideating about things like this, something emerges as a front runner, and it's tempting to jump on it and really get into the details of solving it in that one way. And we try to make sure we're generating lots of different ideas, lots of different concepts. We'll routinely test those with our customers to make sure that we, before we really dig in and start working on that sort of 5%, that we're working on the right 5%.
And sometimes they make improvements that I've been known to call that man right there, my sales rep, and tell him, you need to get over here because this isn't working. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've done that before. So,
do you have any examples? You know, I think you guys have.
Oh, they made some improvements a few years ago to the old Flex 21 greens mower, and I was not happy with some of the changes and modifications. And did Helmut come to that? Yeah, when Helmut shows up at your shop, you know you're probably a squeaky wheel.
What in terms of like a solution in the problem that you faced at Carolina that you've come up with a unique solution that maybe you struggled with for a couple of weeks or months and you did something different than your initial fix?
Well, I've been very fortunate and very blessed with the relationship I do have with that young man. His name's Brent Miller, by the way, with Smith Turf and Irrigation. My first day on the job at Carolina Golf Club was May the 16th, 2005, and he was there. He was there to say hello and introduce himself. And I looked at him and I said, I'm glad you're here because we're going to become best friends and we're going to make some changes because I had inherited an equipment fleet that was a little bit of a hodgepodge and we didn't really have all the equipment we needed. And that's really how I've solved my problems, is working with him and the team at STI to our solutions are finding the right piece of equipment sometimes. Sometimes my problems stem from something is lacking or missing. And, you know, we got a few guys from the UK sitting in here, and I know they always refer to it as a piece of kit. It's about finding the right piece of kit. And we're a good team.
So, Matt, you're a known hickory enthusiast, hickory golf enthusiast. I've played a little bit with hickories, and I'm curious, how does playing golf with that older equipment change the way that you approach turf, or has changed the way?
It was a little bit of an evolution. I mean, we hear the term firm and fast thrown about a lot, and I can tell you that it's Carolina Golf Club has not been firm and fast very much in the last 2.5 years just because of all the rain. But and I even had an older member one time tell me, he said, Matthew, I know you like to control the water, but it's never looked this good when you're in control. And I said, thanks. It's the nicest thing you could ever said to me. And there is still, in the U.S., golfers like green. That's just a fact of life. But who doesn't enjoy 50 yards a roll? And, I mean, I kind of got into hickory golf by accident. Literally, it was I saw a segment on the Golf Channel. Charlie Reimer was interviewing Tad Moore, and the reason they were interviewing him was Sandy Lyle had just recently won his second World Hickory Open. And so I watched this segment, and I just thought, well, that sounds kind of interesting. And grabbed my iPad and went on Tad's website, and I just thought, man, these things are beautiful. They're like works of art. hit the contact button, sent him an email. He called me a couple of days later. We talked for 45 minutes. The next thing I know, I had a set of clubs. And for those out there that think, oh, well, you're playing replicas and that's not authentic, I'll just say if they're good enough for a former Open and Masters champion, they're good enough for me. But to Hickory Golf, it's a lower trajectory, a lot of ground game. And that's the other thing is, you know, I'm fortunate Carolina Golf Club was designed by Donald Ross, and it's got a lot of great features and topography where the ground game comes into play. And it's nice to go out there and experience that on occasion. I still play, you know, with modern clubs. In fact, I just got a new set. Titleist T200s, by the way, but I really enjoy the Hickory Golf, and I've taken my clubs and played some other places. I took them to Pinehurst once, played Mid Pines and Southern Pines.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, Southern Pines with Hickories is really cool, and so is Mid Pines. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gives you more of an appreciation for a lot of the features in a golf course and how they come alive. Edric, with you guys having such a long product line, I oftentimes look back at stuff and I'm like, God, I used to do things really. It was like there's almost like a simplistic brilliance to it. And I'm curious with you're developing innovation, but you've had products forever. Do you ever look back to move forward?
No doubt about that. In fact, you'll have conversations here in the booth where somebody will reference some product from the past and say there was never anything quite like that. And sometimes it's a conversation like that that causes you to look at what made that product so good. And you use the simplistic brilliance sort of statement. At the same time that we're talking about all this modern technology and everything, we need to make sure that we're not making things too complicated, that it doesn't make it difficult for our customers to use the product, to maintain the product. And I know some people may question from time to time, are you forgetting that? But I can tell you without a doubt that we're not, and we've got people very much focused on that. I'll also tell you there are cases in our R&D team where people have worked on concepts maybe 15, 20, 25 years ago, and sometimes they've gone on a shelf or they're stuffed in the back corner, and inspiration will hit, and some of those things will come out and find that those old ideas are actually the solution to the modern problem. That happens all the time.
What's your favorite product that never got out there?
Of course I can't talk about that because I just told you in 20 years you might see it.
I had to ask, I'm curious.
That was an awesome question.
Matt, about you started a public golf course as an assistant superintendent. Looking, back and reflect, like, what was the biggest challenge you faced on the public side that's different than the challenges you face on the private side?
Well, that's a great question. I was the assistant at Augustine Golf Club in Stafford, Virginia for 2 years under Rick Owens. And Augustine was built in the early to mid-90s. It had the reputation as being known as the grandfather of the upscale daily fee in that sort of greater D.C. area. And when I was there, we were doing about 39,000 rounds a year. Big time corporate outings, and some of those were, a full course shotgun, and sometimes it was maybe you were there with 24 guys and Edric was there with 48, and we had a manager that was this master at figuring out how to work the tee sheet like a puzzle. But it was just a major challenge to figure out, where are we even starting prep this morning? We had great communication with the golf shop. Steve Loomis used to be the head golf professional there. He kind of spoiled me. And each day was a unique challenge because maybe we're going out and starting on 11 because where the shotgun was, all these back were shotguns. It was, I always knew that I wanted to be at a private club. I'd grown up, first course I worked at actually was Lake Bonaventure Country Club in Virginia. It was a 9-hole course, but it was a private club. And so that's kind of what I had my eye on. And when I left Augustine, I went to a Swan Point Yacht and Country Club. It's in Issue, Maryland, just south of D.C., right on the Potomac River, semi-private. So again, we're dealing with the public. We had a marketing director that was always trying to generate corporate outing business, et cetera. But you had a component of members, but I was fortunate to land where I did. I couldn't be happier.
Something that just jogged my memory, just came into my thought, is like with the private club, it's nice because you get to know your members. You get to communicate with them regularly. They know almost what to expect when they come out, given times of the year. One of the toughest things with public golf has got to be, like, you don't know which customers are coming out, and they don't know what to expect from your end.
You're exactly right. And, the single biggest reason why I started Twitter in 2013, I think it was, most private clubs had a newsletter, and printed newsletters are pretty much ancient. So then I just started doing regular emails, and I didn't like the platform we were using, so I created my own blog page on Blogger, like in 2011. But so by 2013, I'm having a conversation with the Greens Committee chairman. Carolina Golf Club is a unique club. We're right there close to the heart of the financial district in Charlotte, old classic golf course, and we were turning over about 20 members a year, it seemed, for a significant time. And all the new members that I was meeting were younger and younger and younger. And I thought, well, maybe this is a platform that they would gravitate to. Had a conversation with the Greens chairman. He's like, yeah, I think we should do that. So the whole point of what I put on Twitter, for the most part, with the exception of kind of being down here kind of helping promote the industry and the show as a whole, is Andy, you wake up, you've got a tee time at the club at 10 o'clock, you and your buddies, and hopefully you'll see something that'll kind of give you an insight as to what to expect today. Because I think at the end of the day, golfers that are unhappy, they're unhappy because the golf course didn't meet their expectation, whatever that expectation was. So if I can kind of help sort of give you the right context and to where you'll maybe set your expectations at the right level, then you're not going to be disappointed. Hopefully you'll come away pleasantly surprised. You know, if you see something on there like, oh, well, we vented and top dressed on Maintenance Monday, and you're coming out on Tuesday and you're thinking, oh, well, then the greens are better than you expect, you're coming off the course with a smile on your face.
Yeah, for sure. That's it, you know. Oh, expectation management is like the biggest thing for golfers in general. You know, when I get in trouble with myself is like when I expect to play well and I play like crap. You know, I think that's like the crux of every golfer.
That's all of us. My best rounds are always when I have no expectation of performance.
Yeah. I've just been so impressed by what Matt and others have done. You talk about using a platform like Twitter to communicate to the membership. I remember years ago seeing people trying to hide things that can't be hidden. And if instead of hiding them, you're open about it and you explain a bit about why you're doing what you're doing, I think you're right on the money in terms of people being more accepting of that. The other thing, you talked earlier about Matt's comment 12 years ago, I didn't think robotics had a place, and now I've changed my mind. And Matt shared that on Twitter yesterday. And it turned into a bit of a firestorm of all kinds of descending opinions. But I think that's valuable, too. A lot of these things need some debate and discussion, and it helps us all to think about things differently. If we're open-minded to the different points of view, we educate one another on how things might work. And I see that not only in this topic, but lots of other exchanges between superintendents.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. I think everybody... Everybody's got blind spots, and the way I look at something is completely different than the way other people look at stuff. And I one of the best classes I ever took in college, it was a small 5-person discussion class, and the professor, I had to go, which was a big thing, because it's small. And he was like, listen, the first thing you need to do whenever you're examining like something that's important, it was an urban planning class, and he was like, is you have to remove yourself and your biases from everything. And that's something I think that is so great with Twitter is that, it allows you guys to share information, show what you're doing, and then, other people to weigh in on what they think, because they might look at an issue that you have or something you're doing and think about it completely different.
Oh, definitely. And the information sharing, you know, the thing is, I started it to communicate to the membership. Then what I discovered quickly was how many of us in the industry were also using it. You know, we kind of call it turf Twitter. And, you know, the next thing you know, you've got more followers that are industry related than you do from your club. And we're sharing information and sharing ideas. And I've implemented a couple of things on the golf course that I saw for the first time on Twitter. Phrase mowing being one of them. We phrase mowed our range tee a few years ago. The range tee was it was built in 06. So it was like after 11 years of patching divots, it just, you know, it really wasn't level anymore. And the cost to strip all the turf off of it, laser level it, and regrass it was going to be significant. And I was able to phrase mow it for pennies on the dollar. Grew it back in 21 days. I mean, it was a huge cost savings.
What's phrase mowing? You know?
I think of it like wood planing. You know, if you've ever put a board through a planer and how it takes all that material off. So you're going to remove about a half inch of material in one pass. And so what's left behind is all perfectly smooth. And you can make multiple passes if you needed to. And with warm season grasses like Bermuda grass, it'll grow right back. Now, I'll be honest with you. You watch little videos of it, and you're like, okay, I want to give that a try. When you do it for the first time and you're looking at it, you're like, what did I just do?
Yeah, I imagined you were like, oh, I really hope this comes
back.
You're
like, oh, this better work. Yeah.
that's got to be, I have that fear all the time. It's like, what am I doing? So we talked a little bit about sustainability. How do you know when to water and how much to water?
There's lots of different ways. Moisture meters have become a huge, there's something that, I think I got my first one in 2012. So, you know, within the last decade, there's some technology that has come along in an advancement where we can actually measure precisely what the volumetric water content is in the system to determine if the turf needs water or not. But there's other ways as well. You can take a soil probe and test the moisture. Your eyes can tell you, your feet can tell you, your gut can tell you. There's lots of different ways to tell, but that's what we do. We learn our golf courses in and out like the back of our hands, but by and large, I would say, you know, moisture meters are the biggest way we do that nowadays, and that allows us to water more precisely and use less water.
I imagine that's a focus of yours on the research and innovation side.
Absolutely, and hearing Matt's description of that is music to my ears. I used the term artist earlier, and there's no denying there's a balance of art and science in what Matt and others do, and it's not as simple as only looking at data. On the other hand, bringing more science that provides the artists, the decision makers, the managers with more information that they can put into their decision-making process, we generally think can only help. And I think soil moisture meters are a great example of one where, think of it, Andy, as in if you're driving your car, you look at your fuel gauge to see when do I need to fill up. And you don't every day pull into the fuel station and put in 10 gallons and let half of that spill out onto the surrounding area. You use that gauge to tell you how much you need and when you need it. And I think the turf managers that are using tools like that are much better informed to make decisions that are going to make good use of the water.
Well, when I got my first one in 2012, it was new. We were kind of playing around with it, still trying to figure out how to implement it, I guess you could say. I've got four of them now. You know, we use them daily. When I say daily, we're not really using them in the winter months because we don't even irrigate in the winter months. We can't get it to stop raining at Carolina Golf Club right now. But yeah, every morning in the summer, we are taking readings on every green and then making our determinations. We're sharing that information, me and my assistants, with one another. And then hand watering as the data helps us.
I imagine that's another thing where eventually we're going to be in a place where there's enough information in the system where it could become much more automated.
No doubt about it. And, you know, that's another topic that will elicit some differences of opinions. A lot of people would say they don't want that decision-making and so forth taken away from them. And I look at it a bit like the thermostats in our home. We all might have a different opinion as to what temperature we might be, and that's left to the person managing that room to decide.
My wife and I disagree about that.
Yeah, absolutely. But once you've made the decision about where you want the temperature, I think we all see the value in having a system that's automatically applying heat or cooling to get to that set point that we want. And I think irrigation is the same way. I don't think anybody needs the satisfaction of pushing the button to turn the water off or having to scurry back to turn it off. If you're able to put in the parameters that say, this is the range within which I want to control, then let the system help out and keep you freed up to do something
else.
That's
a great
else.
Way to describe it, Edric, because the thing is, you know, before the moisture meters came along, we used things like a soil probe. You also would just kind of look at the dew patterns in the morning, and you'll start to see when the turf is getting dry. And these were the things that you would do in the mornings and use your experience and use your gut, and you'd go out and you'd say, well, you've looked at the forecast. It's going to be this warm today, so the plant's probably going to need about this much water, and you're out there applying it by hand to this spot and that spot because you're like, I don't want that spot to wilt this afternoon. And then as we started to implement the soil moisture meters, it's really about narrowing down and figuring out what range does the turf perform best. You know, if it's above this, it's too wet. We don't need to water. And if it gets below this, we're going to see stress in the afternoon. And so if we can just maintain it throughout the day within the optimum range, we see less stress, we use less water, and the turf performs better. It's more consistent.
Yeah, it's interesting because at the golf course level, your turf might be just a touch different than the golf course down the street. And your optimum, based off of, you know, also based off of membership, you know, what they like, might be different than, you know, the public course that's seeing 60,000 rounds a year.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, and there's a lot of things I share on Twitter, but one of the things I don't really share is soil moisture meter readings, because the numbers at my course are irrelevant to anybody else out there. You just have to find out what's best for your course and manage your course accordingly.
And there's no denying, even on a given course, sometimes things are different on one end of the property than another, and those are the kinds of local know-how that require that judgment, those managerial decisions of the turf manager that's on the property.
16 always takes less water because 16 goes in the shade way before any other.
Yeah. We'll kind of wrap it up there, but thank you guys for coming and being part of this, and thank you, Toro, for setting this all up. I hope people enjoyed it.
Enjoyed the discussion. Thanks, Andy.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. Thank you, Edric. Thank you, Toro, for doing this. It's been fun. Yeah.
People can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, they know where to find me.
Edric, are you on Twitter?
I am, but I'm a follower because I can't broadcast much of what we're working on, as you can imagine.
You got classified information.
He's a lurker.
Top secret stuff.
He's a lurker.
He's just reading everything.
Of course he is.
I sometimes put out those little red hearts that Matt's not a huge fan of.
Yeah, bring back the star, Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.